case this morning is East Coast Fasteners against Employers Mutual Casualty Company. Mr. Paul.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Brian Paul, and I represent FBI Buildings, Inc. There are three critical principles this Court needs to bear in mind when assessing the duty to defend. First, the duty to defend depends on the facts alleged and the inferences that can be drawn from the facts, not on theories of recovery. Second, the duty to defend does not depend on the merits of the claims. It depends on the nature of the claims. EMC could have a duty to defend even if the claims were completely without merit. And finally, if there is any doubt as to the existence of the duty to defend, that doubt has to be resolved in favor of the insureds. Because we're dealing with a CGL policy, what triggers coverage are inferences of an occurrence and property damage. An occurrence, of course, is an accident. The accident in this case was the spreading of the rust from the fasteners to the siding of the building.
Where does it say in the counterclaim that the rust from the fasteners affected the building?
It does not, Your Honor, and that needs to be inferred from the allegations that are there.
Okay, the allegations that are there seem to appear in paragraphs 16, 17, 18, 19, and 22, and I don't see anything about the rest of the building in those allegations. And it's also at least equally conceivable to me that a rusty fastener in a perfectly treated building piece might not affect the rest of the building at all. It might not. It seems it's an utter matter of speculation. If it were a plastic building, you know, I guess it wouldn't rust at all. If it were a metal building properly treated, maybe it wouldn't rust for 10 years. I look at this, you know, the fasteners have begun to rust, rusting fasteners, repair and replace the fasteners, FBI's been damaged in using the fasteners, lost profits due to crews performing remedial work. Well, that could be putting new fasteners in. I'm unclear what notice and a notice pleading jurisdiction is given that there's a claim here for the consequential damage of the building being hurt. And if there's no claim about that, then why is there a duty to defend?
Let me make two points about that. If it is unclear, and if it might be just damage to the insurance product or damage to other property, then the duty to defend arises.
No, but you're using my word unclear in a way. I'll phrase it more strongly. I see nothing about the rest of the building here. And unless you want to say that insurance companies, merely by the act of writing a policy, have a duty to defend against any claim that comes down the pike, no matter how outside the scope of the policy it is, then some judgment has to be made, even at the duty to defend stage.
They do not, of course, have a duty to defend in every circumstance. But in this case, as the district court said, it is common sense that rust by its very nature would inevitably spread.
No, it's not, I must say, common sense to me. As Judge Wood said, the building could be plastic, incapable of rusting. Or here, I gather, that the building was galvanized, and galvanized steel just doesn't rust. That's the whole point of the zinc coating.
The mere act of the rust spreading from the fastener to whatever surface it is.
But how do we know it did that?
How do we know? The only thing I could think of, if you've got a galvanized building, is that the rust wouldn't spread to the galvanized product. That's just physically impossible. But it might kind of run down on top of the galvanized coating and make it unsightly.
Precisely, and that is physical injury to tangible property or property damage.
But that's not something that one ordinarily thinks of when you talk about rust.
And I recognize that. I mean, there is
a rust stain, which is, I think, the most one might expect here. It seems to me at least different in principle from rust. Now, maybe the complaint could have alleged a rust stain will then appear on the the galvanized metal or something like that.
Right. And let me give you an example from my own experience. I put fertilizer on my lawn, and not thinking, the fertilizer spread onto the sidewalks, and of course it rained. Well, the fertilizer had iron in it, and the rust leached from the fertilizer onto the cement. That is, you know, broadly speaking, property damage. Discoloration is physical injury to tangible property, just like corrosion. And if it's unclear, if it's doubtful, if one doesn't know for sure whether that has or hasn't happened, the insurance company ought to pick up the defense. It ought to step in and champion its insured's cause. Instead, EMC did nothing in this case.
But I'm stuck at the first step of this, which is whether, in a complaint that seems to talk only about the fasteners, the insurance company, or all of us out here in the world, should read this complaint as not really being only about the fasteners, but being about the fasteners and everything else that might have been affected by the fasteners.
Well, I think you have to look at the allegations of rust in paragraph 16. You have to look at the allegations of remedial work in paragraph 19.
I am looking at those, and they remedial work sounds to me like put new fasteners in.
And it could be replacement of siding or scrubbing
the
siding clean.
Why? The fasteners begin to rust. Repair and replace the fasteners. Damage in using the fasteners. Now that's a broad.
If you just repaired and replaced the fasteners, stain, if there was any on the siding, would still be there. Now, if you take the complaint seriously, it's not asking for any relief related to even the coloration of the siding, let alone actual rust of the siding.
Well, I would suggest to you that there is doubt from the allegations of rust and remedial work, and add to that a little common sense. The common sense that rust spreads. It spreads by its very nature from the rusting object to the object into which
it doesn't. If that's your version of common sense, it's just not true. We've already given you examples. Plastic doesn't rust. Or you take your fertilizer example. I assure you, the concrete in your highway didn't rust.
No. Yes, Your Honor. But again, discoloration is physical injury to tangible property. Making something unsightly.
But it's not because rust spreads, right?
Well,
the principle for which you're arguing is common sense is simply false. Now, you might have a different common sense principle in mind, but don't keep repeating one that isn't even true.
Well, I would suggest to you that rust, if you don't want to call it spread, it does leave a mark. That's why we would never leave a rusting can on our new car. We know that if it rains long enough and hard enough, sooner or later the rust is going to go from the can onto our car and at least leave a mark. It may not cause the car to rust, but that is physical injury to tangible property. Where the district court really went wrong was in looking for allegations of negligence. Negligence is not an occurrence.
Well, but back on this, the fasteners and the rust and so on, look, when it gets this cold, it also gets dry.
I apologize.
But there's a notion of consequential damages, and actually what I'd like you to address, if you could, is the way we should read this policy, because another point that you've made is that it's inappropriate, just as a matter of course, to look at the exclusions in the policy instead of allowing the insurance company to review the policy as a whole when it makes that initial duty to defend decision, which I assure you this court is quite familiar with, is a different thing from the duty to indemnify, thanks to the diversity jurisdiction. And it strikes me that if the best I can get out of your complaint is that you're complaining about the damage from the fasteners and consequential damages therefrom, but if you look at the exclusions in the policy, you're still essentially talking about a contract claim. You sold us bad product. That's not what this policy is designed to cover.
In fact, it is, Your Honor. I would disagree with you, and let me raise 2 points about that. First of all, there is nothing in the policies that says negligence must be the causative event or the causative act of the occurrence. The occurrence is the event of injury. Negligence, from a factual standpoint, could be the causative event of that occurrence. But if you look at the policies, it speaks in terms of property damage and an occurrence. That language and all the other language in the policies makes no distinction between tort and contract. These are CGL policies, and by definition are policies of general liability. Furthermore, the policy speaks in terms of covering all damages, quote, because of property damage. An ordinary insured would believe that this covers damages arising from contract. There is simply nothing in the policy language that precludes a breach of contract from giving rise to an occurrence.
But exclusion K bars coverage for property damage to your product arising out of it or any part of it, and then you also have the other exclusions. I'm looking kind of pages 27, 28, 29 of your opponent's brief. It looks like what they're trying to do by contract is say, if you've got a problem, you know, with defective goods being delivered, you have contract remedies for that problem. We're not trying to insure. I mean, you can write insurance for whatever you want to write insurance for, and if you're not writing insurance for that, then it's not part of this claim.
You're correct. And the remedy for the damage to the fasteners is a claim for breach of contract and a breach of warranty.
You would agree that's not under this particular CGL policy. The remedy,
it does not cover the replacement or the repair of the fasteners,
right.
Correct.
Okay, and so, right, because you tried to make clear that you were only trying to talk about the building, which led to a question in my mind about what that $600,000 was, but we don't have to get there right now. If that's the case, though, why don't we get back to the complaint? The complaint's complaining about the fasteners. You seem to be addressing a very odd contract claim. If you think back to Hadley against Baxendale or anything, a contract claim that excludes the core of contract recovery but that allows only the consequential damages to be recovered. Right? I mean,
well,
I think this is what you're...
Well, what I'm saying is the policies cover what would ordinarily be deemed consequential economic loss, which is the damage to the siding of the buildings. Maybe I can explain this a little bit better if I talk about Wausau Tile, which is a Wisconsin Supreme Court case that EMC relies on heavily. And that case gives us insight into why contract claims and breach of warranty claims can give rise to coverage.
Well, I understand that, but I guess what I'm thinking about is impaired property means tangible property other than your product. It can't be used because it incorporated your product, etc. Why isn't that this case?
The buildings are not impaired property under the definition because they can't be, quote, restored to use by the repair, replacement, or adjustment of the fasteners. In other words,
even if it's just discoloration, there's no product you can paint over that'll get rid of that?
Well, that is doing something in addition to repairing, replacing, or adjusting the fasteners. It is scrubbing the rust off or painting the rust over or whatever. It simply does not fall within the definition of impaired property. If you look at the case called Hamlin, where there was defective liquid crystal displays that went bad, causing instrument panels to become useless, there was no physical injury to the instrument panels. Just by swapping out the defective liquid crystal displays, you could repair to use the instrument panels. That provides the contrast with our case. Our case, the property damage to the buildings, cannot be remedied just by taking out the screws and putting in new ones. If I could, maybe I could get back to Wausau Tile. I want to make one point about that. And getting back to your point about contracts, the court in Wausau Tile held that there was no damage to, quote, other property when the component part, the cement, went bad and caused damage to the integrated system, the paving stones into which the cement was incorporated. While the economic loss doctrine may well control someone's ability to bring a tort claim, it does not control whether an insurance company has a duty to defend under an insurance policy. That is controlled by the language of the policies. There is nothing in the policies that excludes from coverage to damage caused by a component part to an end product. The damage to the buildings, discoloration, corrosion, bubbling of the paint, is physical injury to tangible property. So the fact that damage to siding may not constitute damage to other property for purposes of the economic loss doctrine doesn't preclude that damage from constituting, quote, property damage for purposes of CGL coverage. Where the Wisconsin Supreme Court went wrong in Wausau Tile is precisely where the district court went wrong, and that was in going against this court's black-letter coverage principles.
Well, hey, wait a minute. This is not a case governed by this court's law. This is a case governed by state law.
Precisely. And what I mean by that is...
So we're not going to sit around and tell the Wisconsin Supreme Court they made a mistake about Wisconsin law.
No. Absolutely
I'm
not.
And
when I say that, what I'm talking
about... I believe there might be a suitable Bronx cheer in this time.
what I'm talking about are cases interpreting Wisconsin law. Curse Universal, Lockwood, Scottsdale, all these cases from this court interpreting Wisconsin law saying facts, not theories, matter. Look at the inferences that can be drawn from the facts. Nature, not merit. The nature of the claims control, not the merits of the claims. I'll let Mr. Webb speak now. Thank you.
Mr. Webb.
Thank you. May it please the Court, my name is William Webb, and I represent East Coast Fasteners and Closures Incorporated and Plyco Corporation, and I'm here to address the issue of bad faith. And I'd like to begin because many of the issues are similar to the issues that Mr. Paul addressed, and I'd like to address the concern that Judge Wood and Judge Easterbrook had with respect to the issue of rust going from the fastener to the building itself. And where in the counterclaim or the complaint filed by FBI is it that we can look to find that allegation being made? And I think it's important to look at paragraph 17 and 22 of the counterclaim. And in those paragraphs, they say, and this is a quote, and I'm looking specifically at paragraph 22, although I think the wording is very similar, that FBI Buildings has incurred and will continue to incur expenses arising from the repair and replacement of fasteners on the commercial buildings it has constructed. Now, the problem with that particular phrase and the problem with the phrase, the identical phrase in paragraph 17, is that they're inartfully drafted. Our clients did not have any control over how FBI drafted its complaint. In other words, we were presented with a complaint. Whether it was perfectly drafted or whether it was inartfully drafted is not something that we had control over.
I'm not sure why, actually, East Coast Fasteners has any remaining interest here. Haven't you already sold your claim to FBI?
We have. In large measure, other than we've retained a small percentage under the settlement agreement with respect to trying to get the money back that we paid to FBI, as well as the bad faith claim. That's why I'm here addressing the bad faith claim, because that particular aspect has not been assigned to FBI.
But that's so odd. Are you referring to the $600,000 as the small percentage?
Yes, and, okay. And that's a small percentage of the $9.8 million judgment that was entered against the...
It's not huge, but it's not all that small either, but what does that represent? That sounds like it represents the cost of the fasteners that had to be replaced, precisely the not covered part of this insurance claim.
Well, and that... I would have to go back, and I did not, in preparing for today, I did not go back and reread the exact settlement agreement to see if that's broken down.
It may not have said out loud, but what could it be? Certainly the fasteners have been replaced, right? I assume.
Some of the fasteners had been replaced, then they needed replacement again. We gave the money to FBI, and to be honest with you, I don't know what they've done with the money. After the money was given to them, we don't know. But what I'd like to do is to go back to the court's very genuine concern about those particular two paragraphs. And I think that it's important to understand that the paragraph can be read two different ways. And if you look at it, it says that FBI has incurred and will continue to incur expenses arising from the repair and replacement of fasteners on the commercial buildings. The question is, what does the word repair signify or qualify?
Well, the question grammatically is the repair and replacement, that is a phrase that modifies fasteners, and without, grammatically, it doesn't make sense to me to say it means arising from the repair on the commercial building and replacement of fasteners. You wouldn't say the repair on well, a commercial and, building.
And I appreciate that. And again, that may very well be a product of the fact that this was not an artfully drafted complaint. I looked at it and I said to myself, this could very well be saying that it's a repair of the, it's requiring a repair of the buildings, in other words, a repair of the of the damage that has occurred to the buildings, as well as the replacement of the fasteners. Now, the reason why that's a reasonable interpretation is because there's simply no way to repair the fasteners. There's no, at least there's no economically viable way of repairing the fasteners once they begin to rust. In order to do that, you'd have to remove a fastener, put it through some type of chemical process, strip off all of the bad coating, replace all of the good, or replace it with good coating, and put it back onto. That's the only repair that could be made of the fasteners. That's why a very reasonable interpretation of the word repair is that it's referring to the buildings and not to the and not to the fasteners. And if that's the case, then FBI has made a covered claim. I see my time has concluded. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Mr. O'Gallagher.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Brian O'Gallagher, and I represent Employers Mutual Casualty Company. The first major point to establish that I think one that the court has hit upon, there is simply no allegation in this counterclaim that the buildings incorporating the defective fasteners suffered any rust damage.
But why don't you respond to the last point that Mr. Webb made? What's that word repair doing? Economically, nobody's ever going to fix a screw, you know, the way a fastener, if you will, by putting it through that process. It would be insane. It's much easier to just take it out and put a new properly treated fastener in. So why do they keep using this word repair in the counterclaim?
The word is repair and replace the fasteners on the buildings themselves.
I understand there's a phrase, but the word repair, if they really just meant put new screws in, why wouldn't they just say the need to replace the fasteners? And taking it one step further in terms of the way insurance duties to defend are construed, why isn't the existence of the word repair enough to throw enough mud into this water that you at least had a duty to defend, even if at the end of the day it was determined that you did not have a duty to indemnify?
I would respond that there is not enough mud in the water because the phrase continues to say on the buildings. It always makes a distinction between the fasteners themselves and the buildings into which they are incorporated. Any remedial work, any replacement that is ongoing, according to the allegations in this complaint, is restricted to the fasteners themselves. That is the only reasonable reading of this complaint.
So we're supposed to assume that they're going to engage in an absurd economic transaction with respect to the fasteners by repairing some of them and replacing others?
I wouldn't characterize it as absurd, Judge. There may be a process to repair fasteners that have not rusted to the degree of others. That information is not in the record. We're left with the allegations in the complaint which restrict all efforts to the fasteners themselves. The complaint takes care, it's in several allegations, to delineate the fasteners from the building. It continually says on the building. There's simply no suggestion that any rust is transferred to the building.
Well, of course, everyone who drafts complaints is an English major, and they understand the difference between the preposition on and of. I mean, really, as an insurance company, your responsibility isn't to parse quite the way you might expect a professional writer to.
I respectfully, Judge, I don't think this is parsing. The complaint is very clear in what it says. There's a product that is rusting. It needs to be replaced. That is what the complaint quite clearly alleges. I don't believe it's an artfully drafted. I believe it means what it says.
Well, some of them need to be repaired. I mean, as I say, surely if the complaint had said only replaced, then we wouldn't be here. You guys would have resolved this long ago, and that would be that. But it says repair, and you need to give some meaning to that word repair in the counterclaim.
Judge, I think in the context of the complaint, whatever repair or replacement is being done is necessarily on the fasteners themselves. That is what the complaint says. And because it's what the complaint says, there is no allegation that there is no reasonable inference that any rust has spread to the buildings themselves.
What did the damages clause of this complaint ask for?
Ask for lost profits, lost market share, lost
did it,
time.
Did you put a number down?
No, ma'am. It asks for, I submit to you that the damage that the prayers for relief made it very clear what we were talking about was a recall, was a going from building to building, pulling out the old fastener, putting in the new fastener. That is the essence of the complaint, and that's why it doesn't state a covered claim. And that fact, which the district court judge did acknowledge in his opinion, he said there is no credible way to read this complaint to allege damage to the buildings unless you torture the allegation, torture the language of the complaint. The allegation is simply not there. And that point negates the appellant's argument on two propositions. First, that there was an allegation of covered property damage. Second, that there was an allegation of an occurrence. Because what they've told you is that the occurrence that they're claiming exists or was pled was the spread of the rust to the fasteners, and that's just not in the pleading. In fact, as Judge Easterbrook pointed out, it is not necessarily just a common sense inference that this is going to occur. There's a statement in the statement of fact where FBI informed the state court judge that they apply a rust inhibiting paint to their building. So just because the fasteners are rusting, which is what the complaint says, there is no reasonable inference that that rust is going to transfer to the buildings and result in property damage. That circumstance in this complaint negates two fundamental premises that the appellants have claimed exist to justify their contentions of the duty to defend. The first being there's no property damage. The second being that there's no occurrence.
So do you think a Wisconsin court hearing this case, the FBI case against East Coast, would have properly excluded all evidence of damage to the building and refused to award, without permitting a discretionary amendment of the complaint or something like that?
Hearing the coverage case, Your Honor, or hearing
No, hearing this counterclaim we're talking about. Now we're in a hypothetical courtroom in Wisconsin, and the court's hearing the case, and FBI comes in and says, here are our witnesses to testify about the amount of damage to the buildings themselves these rusty screws caused, and they come up with, these millions of dollars, $8 or $9 million worth of damages beyond the mere replacement of the rusty screws. Do you think, under this complaint, under a notice pleading jurisdiction, paragraph 18, FBI has been damaged in using the fasteners, FBI is suffering lost profits, etc., I think a Wisconsin court would have to exclude that evidence and not permit FBI to handle the case in that fashion? Would that be an expansion of the case somehow?
Judge, if that those particular damage claims had not been revealed in subsequent discovery or subsequent amendments to the complaint, I believe a court would be justified in holding that counterclaim does not put the opponent on notice that what's being sought is damage suffered by the building.
Why isn't it enough in a notice pleading jurisdiction to say there were rusty fasteners, they damaged us, we want our money?
Because the complaint also says in the same allegations, we're going to replace the fasteners. That's the problem that your defect has created. We're going to fix it. We want the money back from you to replace the fasteners. That's the claim that's pled.
It's a too many facts kind of problem. If they had filed a more abbreviated complaint along the lines of what I just said, then you would have to defend them. There were rusty fasteners. We were damaged. We want our money. Something like the forms that exist after the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure.
Well, if the complaint was so open-ended that it could be inferred that there was a property damage to the building, potentially.
Well, what about my complaint? You sold us rusty fasteners, obviously identifying sales in the time period so that FBI would know, or so that East Coast, would know which fasteners it was, so there's notice. We've been damaged. We want such damages as we can prove in court. You don't have to allege a specific number of damages in a federal court, and not in Wisconsin either, apparently. Would that be enough? Because if that's enough, and if this is only about whether they accidentally pleaded themselves out of court in this complaint, that's perhaps a different situation for a duty to defend determination.
Well, I just don't know if that would be enough. I don't think it would, Judge, if the complaint you suggest did not go so far as to allege resulting damage to a property that is distinct from the insured's product itself. But I submit to you that is not where we were with this case. But this case
isn't about the insurance. Mm-hmm. The original counterclaim is simply, you know, it's a lawsuit brought by somebody who bought a bad product, and they claim that the bad product injured them. And as you well know, there's a lot of law and contracts about when you can and when you can't recover consequential damages. It depends on all sorts of things, warranties and notice and, you know, all of that.
Well, your scenario, Judge, possibly there would have been a duty to defend, but here we don't have that scenario because we've got a counterclaim that alleges that really takes care to allege the replacement of the defective product is the essence of the claim. But to move on, if I may, even if I submit to you under Wisconsin law, which is controlling here, under the Wausau Tile opinion, even if the counterclaim could be read to suggest the inference of physical damage that the appellants would want you to make, there still would be no coverage, because under Wausau Tile, it's very clear that the factual scenario described in the counterclaim, even giving them their inference, does not implicate an occurrence. The Wausau Tile case, contrary to what Mr. Paul told you, did not hold that there was no occurrence because the damages were limited to an integrated product in which the defective component was incorporated. What the Wausau Tile case said was, we've got a claim that about a defective product. We also have a claim that the defective product has caused damage to adjoining property. And because it's the manufacturer who's just seeking to recoup their commercial expenses, there's still no occurrence here. So even giving that inference, the inference they want you to draw, which I don't think is justified, but leaving that aside, even giving them that inference, there still would not be coverage under the Wausau Tile holding, which is controlling here. And those would be the first two reasons to find for the appellee in this case, for EMC. First of all, there's no allegation of there is no concrete allegation of property damage or an occurrence. Secondly, even giving them the inference they want, they still lose on the occurrence requirement. Then you go to the exclusions themselves that we cite in the policy, which Your Honor has pointed out, your product exclusion, the impaired property exclusion, the product recall exclusion, and the contractual liability exclusion are all applicable here to negate a duty to defend. So it can't be said reasonably that a duty to defend ever arose based on the allegations in the four corners of the complaint as compared to the policy provision. Even if the next point I need to raise is that even if there was a duty to defend, even if the allegations could be construed somehow as to create a duty to defend, there is the question of this judgment, and we raise that in our brief, whether or not it's enforceable against EMC. And I would submit to you that even if there's a finding of a duty to defend, there is no duty to indemnify with respect to that judgment because of the collusion that was inherent in the procurement of that judgment. And we spent some time in the briefs on this. What we've got is a situation here where East Coast and Plyco have essentially entered into a partnership, for lack of a better word, with FBI in an effort to manufacture a judgment and then enforce it against EMC.
Why isn't that a very ordinary thing where to call this collusion? Are you going to say every time the ultimately injured party settles and there's a claim assignment, there's some sort of collusion?
No, ma'am, I'm not. What I'm saying is that in a situation where the insured settles with the underlying plaintiff and agrees, for example, to take a consent judgment or to say, go in court, prove whatever damage you can prove, we're not going to contest it.
Right, nobody's depriving you of your day in court to contest every dollar of that.
But that's not the situation here. The situation here is the insured retained a percentage of the judgment. They stand to gain something like $660,000 back. Now, that creates a different scenario because that's not the insured cutting its losses and getting out of a bad situation. That's the insured standing to profit economically by the judgment that's entered against it. And courts, I've cited the Westerfield case as the best example of this. That scenario is peculiar, and it raises questions as to the process of the procurement of that judgment. Here we've got East Coast and PLETCO are retaining an interest of, I think, as much as $650,000 in the judgment that was entered. They've told you, or they at least told the district court, that whatever settlement payment they made to SBI was for replacement of the fasteners, non-covered damages. So the payment they've made to SBI, they have no basis under the policies to recover that payment. Those were payments for non-covered damages.
Yeah, well, I understand that, but I still don't see why that makes it collusion. I mean, you know all this. You were part of it. I mean, maybe you don't think it creates a basis for your responsibility eventually to pay, but you have every opportunity of presenting that. Say it's not under the policy. It's this way of splitting the expenses. Something we can be part of.
The collusion I'm speaking of is a situation where the interests of the insured and the underlying plaintiff become aligned against the carrier. And I
that bars all assignments. The insured can never
assign
because then the interests become aligned too.
No, not if the insured doesn't retain an economic interest in the judgment. If the insured assigns the claim against the carrier and says, here, you take a judgment against us for $1 million, you can't enforce it against us, you can only enforce it against the carrier, and then you go chase the carrier, that's different than saying, you go chase the carrier, but I get 25%, because then you're partners at that point. Then you have an interest in increasing
the... So what if they assign 75% of their claim? Well, you know, you have a claim against us for $1 million, we'll let you enter a judgment, a claim against us for $750,000.
With the insured assign that to the...
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me something close to the same result could be achieved by the terms of the assignment.
Any scenario where the insured is ultimately going to profit by the judgment that was entered against them, I think, raises the specter of collusion, particularly as in a case like here where the district court judge, or excuse me, the state court judge was not informed of what was going on. So the state court judge heard evidence that painted East Coast and PLETCO as wrongdoing parties. The state court judge enters a judgment against them without the knowledge that in doing so, he's going to create a windfall for them. I think, respectfully, I think that goes to the integrity of the process, and that circumstance alone gives this court an incentive to prevent that judgment from being enforced because it subverts the process.
And did you raise this before the state court judge?
Judge, we filed a motion to intervene, and it was denied.
Pointing out this very problem.
What we pointed out, Judge, was we thought this was going to occur. We did not have sworn statements or evidence or a settlement agreement. We didn't get the settlement agreement that really laid this arrangement out until, I want to say, 2 months after the state court entered his judgment. So we couldn't run into court with the settlement agreement saying, Judge, here's what they're planning to do. All we could give the judge in the state court was our suspicion. We did try to discover the settlement agreement. We asked for its production. We didn't get it. We filed 2 motions to compel to get it. We didn't get it until September after the judgment gets entered in July, and the settlement agreement itself says it was effective in April. So respectfully, I would submit we were blocked from the information we needed to go in front of the state court judge and convince him that what was happening was improper. Mr. Webb spoke about the bad faith ruling. Again, even if there's a finding of a duty to defend here, the bad faith ruling must be upheld. Really, the Wisconsin, this is a duty to defend case. It comes down to whether or not the allegations in the counterclaim created a duty to defend. There's a lot of citation in the briefs about first-party cases on the bad faith issue, where there's obviously a duty to investigate because of the different nature of first-party coverage as opposed to liability coverage. The bad faith ruling was correct, as demonstrated by the fact that the district court judge agreed with our construction and interpretation of the complaint. Simply, even if the court disagrees with our duty to defend decision, it was not so unreasonable as to give rise to a bad faith claim under Wisconsin law. And so again, even if the duty to defend ruling is overturned, the bad faith ruling must stand. There's also a Rule 60 issue that we get to. There was a Rule 60 motion that was filed attacking the choice of law decision. The judge denied the Rule 60 motion. The judge's decision should again be affirmed on that point. The Rule 60 motion was filed about a year after the choice of law ruling. It was filed about 11 months after the information was received that it found significant as to the choice of law, and the judge denied the motion as untimely. There's been no suggestion that the district court judge acted improperly in that finding, and there's been no explanation of the delay in bringing the Rule 60 motion. So again, that's another basis to affirm the district court's ruling. I would also submit to you that certain arguments have been waived by FBI and East Coast in their briefs. We did file a motion on that, but I just want to take a brief time to talk about it now. In the district court, FBI argued extensively that there was a duty to defend issue was controlled by the terms of the underlying state court's judgment. They reversed field from that point in their brief before this court and argued that really you had to analyze the language in the counterclaim to try to find allegations of property damage. This is not an argument they asserted in the district court, and to claim that the district court erred in rejecting their arguments based on new arguments, I think, was improper, and certain arguments advanced by FBI have been waived. The separate waiver issue applies to East Coast and PLICO. East Coast and PLICO, and this is on the choice of law argument, in their brief, East Coast and PLICO argue for the application of Indiana law to the construction of the policy. They did not make that argument in the district court. In the district court, we moved for judgment on the choice of law issue. We advocated for the Wisconsin law, and there was no opposition. What East Coast claimed in the district court was that the choice of law determination was premature. They did not argue to apply Indiana law to this case. They just simply argued that you should defer the choice of law decision until the until discovery is closed. They never renewed the choice of law issue. And when we then filed our motions for summary judgment, the issues were argued under Wisconsin law. And these are the issues I'm speaking of, the issues of the duty to defend and the construction of the insurance policies. So I think at this point, East Coast and PLICO are precluded from going back and re-arguing the choice of law issue that they never argued in the district court. In fact, the choice of law determination was proper, even if you examine the choice of law test in the manner of treating East Coast as a named insured on the policy. As the court has seen, the policies in the record, the policies were issued to PLICO Corporation, which is a Wisconsin corporation. East Coast is named as an additional insured. They're an Indiana corporation.
They make a big deal out of the fact that you changed from a position in which you apparently were saying that the rights of an additional insured were somewhat lesser than the rights of the named insured to a position where you were saying it didn't really matter.
That's correct. They do make a big deal about that, Judge. But the point is, East Coast was and always is named as an additional insured on these policies. There is a endorsement that's in East Coast in PLICO's appendix.
Right, but the rights of an additional insured in most insurance policies, anyway, once you've qualified, as it were, are the same as the rights of the named insured.
Well, Judge, usually, and East Coast was named as an additional insured on this policy through a particular form. And the form says that the additional insured isn't insured only with respect to liability that arises out of the conduct or the operations of the named insured.
Typical. So if the additional insured has a wholly separate line of business, you know, they have a women's clothing subsidiary too, it's not covering that. It's covering their fastener business. But that doesn't really apply much here, does it?
I don't think it's significant in terms of the choice of law issue. It was the limitation on East Coast coverage could have been significant if PLICO was not a defendant in the underlying case. But since PLICO was sued on an equal basis with East Coast, and the conduct alleged against both of them was essentially identical, the limitation on coverage in the additional insured endorsement ultimately was not that significant. And that was the basis of our informing the other side we weren't going to assert that argument at the summary judgment stage. It had nothing to do with the choice of law decision. And there's a lot of talk in the brief about how that changed the whole choice of law analysis. It did not. It was not significant from a choice of law perspective. If it was, it would have been incumbent upon FBI or East Coast to go back in, as the district court told them they could, and reopen the choice of law issue. But if you look at the choice of law factors, even if you elevate East Coast to the same status on the policy as PLACO, you come to the conclusion that Wisconsin law clearly controls the case. There are five choice of law factors. The first choice of law factor and the second choice of law factor are place of contracting and place of negotiation. Both of those factors, no one disputes, completely favor Wisconsin in that the negotiation and issuance of this policy, of these policies, occurred fully in Wisconsin. The other three factors, if you elevate East Coast to the same status as PLACO, become indeterminate. The third factor is place of performance. Since both PLACO and East Coast were, if you concede that they're equally insured, PLACO's operations are in Wisconsin, East Coast operations are in Indiana. So there's no way, by elevating East Coast on an equal status with PLACO, you can say that Indiana controls that factor. It's still half Wisconsin, half Indiana, so at best it's indeterminate. The same situation with the subject matter of the contract test. And the third factor is the place of domicile. Well, here the domicile of PLACO is what? Wisconsin. The domicile of East Coast is Indiana. So just by elevating East Coast to an equal footing with PLACO doesn't change the choice of law analysis. What they want you to do, or what they've claimed, is they claim that Indiana law is going to apply because East Coast is an additional, is a named insured. That would elevate East Coast over PLACO, which you just can't do. The decision to apply Wisconsin law was proper, and my time is up.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Paul?
Allow me to take the court back to the duty to defend, and I recognize this court has questions about the counterclaim. But the obligation is not on the plaintiff or the counterplaintiff in this case to plead allegations of property damage and an occurrence. Their obligation is to state a claim for relief. The obligation is on the insurer to read the counterclaim so as to ascertain the duty to defend whenever possible. Whenever possible. Not in all circumstances, but whenever possible. And this is because we are operating under a notice pleading regime where we plead facts, not theories, and we don't have to plead all of the facts, just the operative facts. The counterclaim or the complaint is supposed to be short and plain. So all of these things have given rise to rules such as read the counterclaim liberally. If there is any doubt as to the duty to defend, defend. That's where these rules spring from. The fact is, there is no way to rule out or foreclose that this counterclaim is talking about damage to the buildings. And since you can't foreclose that, EMC had a duty to defend. This court used that same analysis in a case called Roman Catholic Diocese. It used common sense and the idea that a coverable claim could not be ruled out. I acknowledge there are no direct allegations of property damage in an occurrence. Well, the rust to the fasteners is property damage, but I'm talking about buildings. But that inference, the damage that has been done to the buildings, can be inferred. I acknowledge, again, that the essence of the counterclaim may well be taken to be talking about the damage to the fasteners. But as this court said in Curtis Universal, you do not look and focus on the essence of the counterclaim. You look on the allegations that may give rise to a duty to defend or are talking about property damage and occurrence. Now, as to Wausau Tile, it's an important case. And this court needs to understand what the Wisconsin Supreme Court did there. As to the damage to the paving stones, it says there was no damage to other property for purposes of the economic loss doctrine. As to the damage to the individuals who had tripped over the broken paving stones, or where the paving stones had injured other property, the court said that those claims were barred by the real party and interest rule. The economic loss doctrine and the real party and interest rule do not control coverage. The language of the policies control coverage. Furthermore, the fact that these claims may have had zero merit under the economic loss doctrine of the real party and interest, did not matter. Under Scottsdale, an insurance company has a duty to defend even if a claim is false, fraudulent, or groundless. It does not matter. And in fact, as this court said in Scottsdale, the language is actually broader than that now. They used to say we have a duty to defend even if the claim is false, fraudulent, or groundless. Now it says we have a duty to defend any suit making allegations of property damage and an occurrence. look at this court's case in Coring, K-O-E-H-R-I-N-G. That case is from 1965, but it is still good law and provides excellent insight into our arguments. It says that the duty to defend does not depend on whether a plaintiff is claiming contract or negligence or breach of warranty. The duty to defend depends on the language of the policies, property damage, and occurrence. If the court wants to go beyond that, it can look at the case called Vandenberg. It's a case from the California Supreme Court that explains this in better detail. The fact is, an insurance company has a duty to defend if there is any doubt whatsoever, that coverage has been triggered. And this case tests whether any doubt really means any doubt. There was doubt in this case, and so EMC should have defended. Instead, EMC did nothing, and it breached its policies. We therefore ask this court to reverse and remand for further proceedings. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.